Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Today, we look at medical treatments and devices that may change how diseases are diagnosed and treated. Just about a decade ago, when the human genome was sequenced, many scientists believed that a new world of biologically based medicines were on their way. Here's President Bill Clinton heralding the news in 2000.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind. More than 1,000 researchers across six nations have revealed nearly all 3 billion letters of our miraculous genetic code.
But today we face two huge problems. Big diseases like cancer and Alzheimer's feel intractable, and healthcare costs continue to skyrocket. This hour, we'll look at biotechnology and whether it has the potential to revolutionize the cost and effectiveness of medicines. And I'm joined in the studio by David Lucchino, CEO of Sempris Biosciences, which aims to reduce the complications caused by medical devices. David Lucchino, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined by Dave Steinmiller, COO of Opco Diagnostics, which is working to change the way we diagnose certain diseases. Dave Steinmiller, thanks for being here, too.
Thanks very much.
And finally, by Michael Sima, a professor of materials science and engineering at MIT. He holds 37 U.S. patents and has worked on addressing cancer and metabolic diseases, among others. Michael Sima, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So let me go to you, Michael Sima, on that first question. We heard Bill Clinton heralding the sequencing of the human genome, and there was a lot of excitement around that. But 10, 12 years have passed. Is that an area where really amazing drugs are going to come from, the idea that we've now been able to see what that human genome looks like?
Well, without question, the genome has been the foundation for discovery and a basic understanding of disease. And many diseases are linked to very specific defects in the genome, but not all diseases. But what's interesting and what's happening now is that the connection between – or genetic information is becoming ubiquitous. The electronic health records that we know of now are going to be filled with genetic information. But what's not there is the connection to the real description of the disease. Many diseases are complicated interactions between these genes and their environment and many genes at once. And unraveling all that is still remains to be done.
It's interesting because certainly people can now send away for a kid, or they can, for not very much money, generally under $1,000, right, get their gene sequence.
It is traumatic. If you look at the cost of sequencing as a function of year, you have to do it on a log scale. It drops orders of magnitude per year. It in the very near future, you can predict that it'll be very easy to get the entire genomic sequence of an individual patient.
So I'm actually going to play a little clip for you of physicist Michio Kaku on the BBC. And he did one of these fairly low-cost genetic tests. And he sort of talks about how this may change diagnosing disease. Let's listen.
A simple blood test will reveal whether I carry a risk gene for Alzheimer's, or for heart disease, mental illness, diabetes, indeed, all the major diseases. Soon, genetic screening to map out our entire medical future will be as routine as checking our blood pressure.
Dave Steinmiller from Opco Diagnostics, do you have the sense that this kind of ubiquitous testing where everybody knows what's in their genes and what they're inclined towards is coming very soon?
Yeah, I think it is. I think going back to the statement that Michael said about how quickly the cost of sequencing is dropping, you know, we think of how quickly computing power is increasing, and the speed of improvements in sequencing far exceeds what we see in the computer industry, which is boggles my mind. But I think the statement that we'll know our genetic future from our genome kind of understates the importance of the genome project. Yes, it's important to know whether or not you carry genes for this and that disease. But now that scientists have the map, which is the genome, and the starts of the map, and they can start filling in all the uh, the unknown areas on that map, we can start to understand how disease progresses and how to treat diseases. So the importance of the Genome Project, I think, exceeds or far exceeds the diagnostic aspects of it. I think it's more the just the knowledge and the ability to act on that knowledge is what's important.
And do we really have any sense of how different genes interact with one another? I mean, I know that there are certain genes, the breast cancer genes are well known, that might be able to indicate whether you have a very high risk for that. Aren't there other genes that interact with environment? Are you really going to be able to tell whether you're going to get Alzheimer's from mapping your genetic code? Michael Sima.
Well, I think it's not going to be quite as simple as that. I mean, I think there's a project being being led by MGH that is very exciting, because what they're trying to do is begin the connection between genetic information and the description of your health. We call it the phenotype. So right now, the connection between phenotype and genome, phenotype being, you know, the details of your physiology on a macro level, isn't really well known. But if there were a way to populate, for example, electronic health records with enough data on your phenotype, your description of you as a person.
So you might have a genetic code for whatever kind of hair, but in reality you have brown hair.
Yeah, or you know, diabetes is actually a complex disease, for example. You can become a diabetic for a number of different reasons. Just being a diabetic doesn't tell you which one of those reasons caused your disease. To make that connection, to be the real engine for discovery that the genome represents, it's making that big leap between the complicated code of the genome and what the disease is really like.
David Lucchino from Sempris Biosciences, it seems like we're talking in some sense about understanding disease on an individual level instead of coming up with a remedy and saying, everybody, take this remedy. Do you see approaches to disease is getting more personalized as time goes on?
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. Sort of interestingly, about a month ago, I went and did a genetic testing for myself through a service that you could, you know, provide a sample, and they tested a service called 23andMe. And I was able to sort of see on a probability basis whether or not I had certain, you know, traits, where my genetic ancestry came from. And also it gave me a health profile. And I think part of this is each individual's responsibility to want to go out and try to sort of connect the dots as it relates to their own sort of genetic profile and understand sort of predispositions that they may or may not have towards, you know, wanting to, you know, have to stay physically fit or, you know, stay away from certain, you know, certain habits in their life. Because I think the real issue is around prevention, which is sort of another big macro trend that's going on. And so our genetics you give us a predisposition for something, but it doesn't necessarily require that that's going to happen. And, you know, we all have to understand what our genetic profile is.
Isn't it a little scary to take that kind of test and find out? I don't know what it was like for you, but find out that you're inclined towards something that, you know, you have. Let's say you're inclined towards Alzheimer's. There's no food you can eat. There's, you know, there may be no amount of running you can do or smoking you can quit to get away from that. Isn't that a little overwhelming?
Yeah. I mean, they in the test that I took, they give you the option not to find this information out. And so I think it's the right way of doing it. It's all about our own individual choice to do that. But, you know, I think, you know, something as straightforward as understanding your genetic profile and then connecting it to work that, you know, Michael referenced at MGH, which is really where sort of the value is created. How do we sort of understand larger trends and profiles based off of real, you know, medical data that can then be correlated to someone's genetic profile? That's where I think, you know, great things happen. And because the idea is, how do we all live a healthier, you know, ideally happier life? And connecting to our genetic profile is a critical way of doing that.
Well, one final question about this. I mean, how do you sort of deal with the implications of this kind of information being known not just to you but to a company, right? 23andMe knows this data just as much as you know the data. And we've already obviously had a lot of discussions in this country about do people get health care when they have pre-existing conditions?
Yeah, I think there's a whole body of law that probably needs to be written around that. I mean, you could have, you know, genetic – people steal your genetic, you know, code and test it without you knowing it. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, unfortunate things that can happen. But I think there's a lot of great things that can happen. And that's where, you know, our sort of society needs to advocate for ourselves. But I think it's folks like, you know, here in this room and other folks that were looking to be on the cutting edge and not do something for science sake, which is a wonderful thing in itself, but to really come up with products that can, you know, impact people's lives and really save lives and really lessen the healthcare burden on people.
And Dave Steinmeier, do you see this trend of personalization in biotech, or are there other important trends in biotech that you think trump the idea of personalization?
There's many trends, but so I'm hesitant to say that personalization is the most important trend, but it is very important. Jumping back on what David said about that the potential good from this, from having your genome sequenced, is great, but obviously there's risk involved as well, as you mentioned. That I think adds to the urgency of doing things like ensuring that you can get health care if you have prior existing conditions or someone is aware of your genetic code, because that's coming. And as a society, I think it behooves us to prepare ourselves for that and to put ourselves in a situation where everyone is safe with this information, because the risks are great, but the advantages are even greater. Imagine, you know, there's an enormous amount of variability in humanity, and there's so much to be known from everyone's genomic data, as well as their proteomic data, their metabolic data. That's not going to be accessible if we're living in a world where we're too afraid of actually finding out that information.
How is it going to change medicine, do you think, when we all know this kind of information about ourselves, that we have this much inclination towards breast cancer, this much inclination towards Alzheimer's or whatever it is? I mean, how is it going to change when I know the information?
I'd like to take the focus a little bit less away from I have the inclination toward this disease to know how will I react to, let's say, a pharmaceutical. I think that's the thing that gets me very excited about personalized medicine. Certain drugs will work for certain people. Certain drugs won't work for certain people. Elucidating that will both speed the approval and the development of new drugs and also greatly increase their effectiveness and obviously reduce costs.
Are there examples of that already happening?
Oh, plenty. I think one in cancer that's quite well known is the Herceptin drug from Genentech. There's a marker that I think about 30% of women who have breast cancer have, and for those women, the Herceptin drug is effective, and for those who do not have that marker, it's not effective at all. And so, imagine if you were doing a clinical trial, if you did not take that into consideration, you've got an enormous amount of non-responders. That changes how the FDA is going to look at your drug. That changes how physicians are going to wonder if they're going to use your drug, not knowing why it is or is not working. And it's going to change reimbursement.
Michael Sima, I wonder, too, we're sort of talking about the intersection of biotech and computing, right? Because it's computers that make us able to, in a fairly cheap, quick way, sequence our genome, right? Isn't it the power of computing?
Well,
no?
I think it's a combination of the power of computing and the power of a very powerful set of chemistries that allow you to reveal a sequence of the genome. And so it's I think that's a big element of it, but it's not just that. It's real wet chemistry with a real very high specificity to what's there.
So if we look at biology, chemistry, computing, maybe even material science, tell me ways in which there are different fields coming together to change biotech.
Oh, well, that goes beyond just the genome.
Sure.
Just about every area of medicine relies on more than just biology. And to make a drug product these days, you have to bring skill sets from across the board. And if you want to make a medical device, it's skill sets even broader. And so these – or a diagnostic. We have – I have a founder of a diagnostics company. We have mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. We have chemists. We have physicists. We – you know, it's a broad range of people that have to come together to make these types of advanced products.
And tell me one or two products that you think are really interesting. Could be something that you're working on, something that somebody else is working on, but where these – two or three disciplines are coming together to create something new and interesting and
powerful.
Well,
I was just talking about diagnostics. A company called T2 Biosystems, they are working on a product that will be able to test very rapidly for the presence of fungal disease in a patient. So if you're in a hospital and have a fever of unknown origin, they think you have a bacterial infection, and then they'll take a blood sample. They'll start treating you because it takes too long to find out whether you have a bacterial disease. And they keep on hanging antibiotic bags at $1,000 a piece until nothing happens. And then they think, well, you must have had fungal disease because the blood culture hasn't come back because it'll take 5 days to find out.
Wow.
And if you are unlucky enough to have fungal disease, by day two, you have a mortality rate of 30%. So, and it takes 5 days to find out which bug it is. So, you know, there's a really big unmet medical need. That's probably the fourth leading cause of hospital-acquired infection. So bringing people together to address this, to get the high sensitivity and be able to do a test in 90 minutes that is clinically relevant, we needed people from across the board to do that. Not just chemists, but we had to develop a new way to amplify the signal. It's not special techniques called PCR to amplify the presence of genetic material in a sample. But at the levels we were talking about, that was not sensitive enough. And
fungal disease, is it? It's, you said it's common even in the U.S.
There are so many patients in the hospital that are immunosuppressed. You may have cancer, or you may, for whatever reason, and these bugs are on all these surfaces. They're on your hands, and if a catheter goes in, and unfortunately it was contaminated, a patient that's immunosuppressed could end up with a systemic fungal infection, and these can be quite dangerous, and they're difficult to treat, primarily because they're can be diagnosed too late.
And David Lucchino, talk about what Sempris is doing, which I know also aims to, in some ways, cut costs while improving healthcare outcomes.
Yeah, I think the first thing is, you know, as any person in the healthcare business would tell you, if you're not taking costs out of the system and improving patient outcomes as your primary focus, you don't really have a business these days because there's such pressure on the whole healthcare system to really deliver value. You know, our particular value proposition at Sempris Biosciences, it's a venture-backed company out of MIT, 30 employees nestled right in the middle of Kendall Square, is a lot of what, you know, Michael had talked about, which is, you know, really stopping the problem before it starts in terms of, you know, eliminating bacteria that can colonize or create biofilms off the surface of a medical device and also stop blood from clotting off the surface of a device.
So what kind of devices are we talking about?
So the first device we have in front of the FDA right now is a vascular access catheter. It's called a peripherally inserted catheter. The catheter, they sell about $1 billion a year in catheter sales, but catheters themselves create about $10 billion in infection-related costs and complication costs. So it's inverse. I mean, so here's a product that people need to deliver and exchange fluids from the body that are creating 60,000 deaths a year from infection and billions of dollars of cost above the product themselves. And that, you know, that's just a head scratcher on why that's the case. And there's many different ways of really trying to solve this problem. And ours is dealing with creating a surface that doesn't elute, that essentially coordinates water that can, at the molecular level, that can stop bacteria from sticking and blood from clotting off the surface.
Okay, now why would you need a vascular catheter? What kind of issue would you be dealing with?
Let's say you're going in for chemotherapy treatments. You know, a lot of time picks are used for, you know, cancer patients. You know, know, delivering total parental nutrition to patients. You know, anytime you need access to the vascular system to withdraw fluids or to deliver fluids to the body, it's a workhorse for the healthcare industry. And it's a rather lowbrow product, but it's a product of critical importance to make sure that patients aren't getting more complications than the situations are already dealing with.
Now, we're talking about the idea of coming up with products that also lower healthcare costs, and I guess I wonder whether even all the products that we could put together here at this table from your respective companies, is this going to make any dent at all in healthcare costs?
I would say, and I'll let everyone else speak for themselves, but absolutely. We're incentivized to, first and foremost, to help patients. You know, that's why people in this room and I think all throughout healthcare get up every day. Then I think, you want to build a successful company, and a successful company is only going to be successful if you can prove its effectiveness. And so ultimately, the standard when you go to hospitals, you go to group purchasing organizations, is to be able to have data that can prove that this technology actually does what it says it can do. It's not a nice to have, but you got to have the data and the facts to back it up in order to get paid and get a premium for it.
Dave Stanmiller, talk about the ability to change this huge, massive debt that we are building up because of healthcare.
So, I don't think there's one technology that's going to solve the healthcare funding issue in the United States. But every one of these technologies, as David mentioned, has the potential to reduce costs in certain ways. And just to take the two examples that were discussed here. So David's product greatly reduces complications due to a catheterization. Well, that's extremely important because it's those complications that are the real expense in medical care, going back to the hospital after a procedure, staying in a hospital after a procedure. Likewise, the fungal test is extremely important because hospital-acquired infections are a large part of the budgetary problems that hospitals have. So every one of these things, not a single technology is going to cure all the healthcare costs. When you think of something as large as the genome, as we talked about before, that has the potential to move the needle, but not itself. It's all the spin-outs that come out of that technology.
Dave Stanmiller from Opco Diagnostics, Michael Sima from the Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research at MIT, and David Lupino of Sempris Biosciences. Stay with us. We will be right back to talk about both new medicines and new diagnostic possibilities. Could tests for cancer and other diseases soon be available at the drugstore rather than at your doctor's office? Remember that you can listen to this entire show or any of our past shows online at wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can connect to our iTunes podcasts. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.